From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Korean Context. For this episode, we have a guest host, KEI's Senior Director for Congressional Affairs and Trade, Troy Stangarone. As all you North Korea watchers out there have probably already heard, on November 30th, the UN passed their second round of sanctions against the North Koreans this year, following the DPRK's second nuclear test of 2016. This round of sanctions is once again being called the toughest sanctions ever against the North Korean regime. Troy sat down with renowned North Korea expert Dr. Stephen Haggard of the University of California, San Diego, to learn more about what exactly is in this new sanctions bill, if it really is tougher than the previous ones, and what else can be done to address the North Korean nuclear issue. Please enjoy.
Dr. Haggard, thank you for joining us on Korean Context.
My pleasure.
The United Nations recently passed new sanctions legislation on North Korea, 2321. At the moment, the international community is pursuing a policy of international sanctions on North Korea to address their nuclear and missile programs, as opposed to trying other alternative tools. Why has there been so much focus on sanctions?
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to join you again on this podcast. I always enjoy coming to KEI. I think the turn towards sanctions over the last 18 months as a primary focus of policy is really related to the acceleration of the testing. It's not just the two nuclear tests this year, which itself is precedent-breaking to have two tests in a single year, but also the increase in the pace of missile testing and the claims on the part of the North Koreans that the missile and nuclear programs are joined in an effort to develop an intercontinental capability. And so I think that's just gotten the attention of the United States politically, the optics of a North Korea that is capable of striking the homeland with a nuclear weapon is just a very different environment than when we were back in 2006 and the first test was of a device and it was pretty clear that it couldn't be or probably couldn't be delivered.
As you noted, this is the second test, and so this is the second set of sanctions that has taken place this year on North Korea. When we look back at the last round, 2270, were those sanctions effective?
Well, I think the short answer to whether the 2270 was effective would probably have to be no, because they weren't effective either in the sense of restarting the negotiations, which are certainly one objective of the sanctions. But even more importantly, they weren't particularly affected in curtailing North Korean trade. And that was what gave rise to the subtle differences in 2321 from 2270. And the central reason why 2270 didn't prove effective was because the primary instrument in 2270 was a restriction on North Korea's export of coal. And actually, this was a quite significant change from past Chinese policy, because previously, controls on exports and trade with North Korea were primarily geared around the weapons of mass destruction program. So we were either trying to limit the financing of the program, we were trying to limit inputs to the program, or we were trying to limit exports that would fund the program. But the big crossing of the Rubicon in 2270 was the Chinese admission that we had to go after North Korea's commercial trade. And that's something which is really quite new and I think did signal quite significant Chinese displeasure. The limit on 2270, the well-known limit, is that there was a so-called livelihood exemption on the coal exports, and the livelihood exemption was essentially self-policed, which meant that self-interested parties could simply claim that this livelihood effect was happening and therefore that the trade in question was exempt. And so the big push, and this really came from the South Koreans as much from the United States, was to try to make the implementation of the coal ban more transparent and clear so that we would have some sort of metric with whether compliance was taking place or not.
Well, as you know, coal was the focus of the last round of sanctions, and coal has been the focus in 2321 as well. So what have we done now to try and address this self-compliance issue?
I should say, first of all, that various restrictions on North Korea's exports of minerals is at the core of this resolution, but it's not the only part of the resolution. The main thing that's happened is that effectively the livelihood exemption has been dismantled. And what we've put in its place with respect to coal is a cap on what North Korea can export in toto. Most of those exports, of course, are going to China, and that cap is 7.5 million tons, or a dollar amount, which is relatively equivalent, or the lower of those two. And what this does is it makes Chinese compliance with the resolution transparent, because before, the Chinese could claim that despite the fact that coal exports were continuing, they were in compliance because the livelihood exemption was a part of the resolution. But now that you have a hard cap, it's impossible for the Chinese to claim that they're in compliance with the resolution if they're in fact importing more than the stated quantities.
Some of the early analysis I've seen of the resolution is people have talked about, well, even the hard caps don't matter because, you know, will they really be enforced? You know, will people smuggle coal or other items? So there seems to be a degree of pessimism on the utility of even this approach. And I guess that leads to maybe two interrelated questions, which would one be is even if we'll say skeptics are correct, that they'll still find a way around it. Is there not utility in making this more difficult for them to do? And two, more broadly speaking, you know, and coal kind of sort of encapsulates this, when we think about sanctions and whether they're working or not working, how should we really conceive them? Is it, as we see sometimes, this sort of incident analysis, or do we need to take a longer-term perspective?
Sure. Well, these are both very good questions, obviously. First, with respect to coal and the capacity to circumvent it, I think anyone who looks at sanctions never assumes that sanctions are going to be airtight. In fact, to the contrary, it's a feature of sanctions that they generate secondary and black markets and smuggling activity precisely because they're prescribed activity. So we can count on that. But to take another conflict area, coal is not the same as diamonds. I mean, it's a bulk commodity, which is difficult to smuggle. And so if you're talking about smuggling, you're talking about quite visible activities that is visible to someone, that sort of activity is taking place. So I think it's harder to smuggle bulk quantities of coal than it is to smuggle other kinds of items, including some dual-use technologies, for example. That said, I think there is a credibility problem with respect to the Chinese because the other parties certainly anticipated that 2270 was going to be enforced with respect to coal. But it certainly makes it harder for China to claim that it's in compliance if it exceeds the limits that are in place. Just two other small questions on this, and then let me come back to the issue of what sanction success means. First is that there are bans on other commodities in 2321, one of them which actually enjoys a livelihood exemption still, which is the iron and iron ore exports. There's also a non-ferrous metal ban, which is probably worth $100 million or so if enforced. And both of those will also be subject to outside scrutiny, though the non-ferrous metal ban does not have the exact kind of transparency measures written into it that the coal cap does. With respect to the success of sanctions, this is, of course, a long-standing debate. The objective of the sanctions, in the particular case of coal, is strategic. It's to try to get back to negotiations. And one of the things that we're concerned about during this transition period, both in South Korea and in the United States, is that the two governments may not be in a position to exploit the effects of the sanctions if they were to actually prove to have bite. And so if you look at the last three or four articles of 2321 and 2270, there are 50 paragraphs of sanctions detail, and then there are two paragraphs that the Chinese have insisted on, that the objective of these sanctions is to get back to negotiations, and specifically the six-party talks. So I think that the sanctions are designed to have economic effect in changing the strategic calculus of the Kim regime. They're also meant to make it more difficult to finance the program, but the ultimate test of their success despite those other objectives, is whether you can get back to talks. And that's a larger diplomatic question. We can talk about that.
It is interesting. Maybe this is a good point to sort of go down this road. We have a new administration coming in the United States with Donald Trump and his team. At some point, it looks like in South Korea, whether it be through the impeachment process or her resignation, we're going to have a new administration perhaps earlier than expected in South Korea. What kinds of challenges do we face in terms of both coordination on sanctions and then moving to a next step, since there does seem to be an agreement that sanctions are a tool to get to negotiations, not an end in themselves?
The Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi made a proposal earlier in the year that for some kind of parallel, what he calls parallel negotiations, in which you'd return to the six-party talks, but to allay North Korean concerns and their demands for discussion of a peace regime, there would be some dual track on which those issues would be taken up, either separately or in what I call a single omnibus negotiation. I actually know on reasonable sources that China was in the process of articulating and writing out what that proposal might look like, and then THAAD deployment stalled further progress on Chinese articulating that, what that process would look like. I think it's worthwhile for the United States to send probably a high-level envoy. This is a process proposition rather than a substantive proposition, but I think that it's important that the United States try to carve this issue out from the other things that are coming in the U.S.-China relationship and try to get cooperation on it, and to invite the Chinese to spell out exactly what the parameters of those talks would be, and to take a forthcoming attitude towards them, even as at the same time that we're pursuing not only multilateral sanctions, but bilateral sanctions, which we could also talk about. Now, on the South Korean piece, the question depends entirely on who's sitting in the Blue House 6 months hence, because you could get an administration under a Ban Ki-moon, which would look somewhat similar to probably what we've been doing. And you could also get one coming out of the Minju Party, whoever that might be, or an alternative coalition that's neither PAK nor core Minju, that would lead to a very different outcome, including a return to more engagement policies. And obviously, the direction that the Trump administration is likely to go, unless it does something unexpected, would put Seoul and Washington more at loggerheads under a center-left government in Seoul than under a center-right government.
Do you think, looking at how Prime Minister Abe has tried to build a relationship early on with Mr. Trump and try to get off on a better foot to avoid some of the challenges people have seen from the campaign, that this is something where, you know, if he's successful, Abe might actually try to come in and sort of bridge some of that gap on policy to try and bring maybe South Korea closer to Mr. Trump and Mr. Trump closer to South Korea?
That's an interesting question, whether Japan might play some intermediary role on this. I would tend to think that the role of Japan is likely to be significant in the context of what the trilateral relationship is. For example, if you did get a center-left government which backed away from the Comfort Woman Agreement or backed away from the Intelligence Sharing Agreement, then obviously the capacity for the United States to present a united front with Japan and South Korea on the North Korean issue vis-a-vis China would be impaired. But I don't see Abe probably playing a direct intermediary role. I think this is something which is going to involve negotiations primarily between Seoul and Washington.
To move back briefly to 2321 itself, there are a few things that stuck out, and I'd be interested if there are other issues that you saw as interesting as well. One deals with there are now specific limits on the number of bank accounts that North Korean embassy officials and consular officials can have. And there also seemed to be a lot more stress on maybe we could say the transportation side in terms of either defining what cargo really is more specifically or putting greater stress on North Korea's ability to utilize ships internationally to conduct trade.
Yes, and I certainly didn't mean to downplay these two components, and you've rightly identified why I think the two other buckets of issues in 2321 are. So let me start with the question of the capacity of the North Koreans to do business abroad. And I use that term broadly because embassies are implicated in this kind of activity. So when we talk about North Korea's trade relations, almost all of us who are working on these issues are focusing primarily on reconstructing the merchandise trade balance. But I think we all know that there have been service income earnings that are much more difficult to track. And their remittances, which are coming from workers, and their profit remittances that are coming from various business activities, which are much more difficult to track because we just don't have the same kind of quality data on those that we do in the merchandise trade. And I don't think we can assume that the merchandise trade correlates with some of these other things. I mean, that's why the so-called battle for Africa, as my colleague Mark Nolan calls it, is not necessarily inconsequential. It may look like it's small, but to the extent that these countries are generating service income of various sorts is non-trivial. So there are a whole series of measures that restrict the North Korean embassies from doing business, though it's not clear whether those parts of the resolutions are obligatory on the member states. There are those that involve limiting bank accounts, which are obligatory. There are hortatory measures about reducing embassy staff. There are restrictions on financial transactions, which have been added and are new. But the main point I want to make about all of this cluster of things, and it's true of shipping, which I'll talk about next, is that they involve not a secondary sanctions diplomacy, but a diplomacy aimed at the jurisdictions to make sure that the jurisdictions in which the North Koreans have embassies are enforcing these things. And I think that that component of the sanctions diplomacy has not gotten the attention it deserves. These sanctions are not self-enforcing. They require that the countries in question, the Romanias, the Mexicos, the Perus, the Vietnams, the Laoses, the Bangladeshes, the Pakistans, all of which are countries, by the way, which have North Korean embassies, are in fact doing due diligence. And in a post I did on my own blog a couple of days ago, we simply looked and ranked the countries that where the North Koreans have embassies by a standard rule of law index, which we take as a kind of proxy for the likelihood that they would comply with these kinds of sanctions enforcement. And something like 40% of the countries with whom North Korea has diplomatic relations are way at the bottom of this index. I mean, they're rogue regimes, to put it in an old-fashioned terminology. Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, and they're states that have just weak capacity, like Laos and Bangladesh, at enforcing these kinds of things. So I think these restrictions are significant, but they really involve due diligence on the part of the jurisdictions in question. Now, let me just say briefly with respect to shipping, the same holds true there, because questions about hiring North Korean crews, whether ships are registered, deregistered, re-registered, whether they can dock, all of these things are things that rely on the jurisdictions in question. And there's been a hearty group of North Korea watchers, Claudia Rosette, Leo Byrne at NK News, that have really spent a tremendous amount of effort to try to track North Korean shipping. And it's pretty clear from that high-quality reporting, and it really deserves credit, that the North Koreans have been able to circumvent a variety of restrictions on their shipping that have taken place in the past. So again, I think that this is a question of sanctions enforcement, not through secondary sanctions, which is a separate topic we should probably talk about, but through doing the diplomacy that tries to restrict these prescribed activities.
Speaking of secondary sanctions, the United States has tools to utilize secondary sanctions against Chinese financial institutions and others who are engaging in illicit trade with North Korea. You know, in the case of the financial side, anyone basically who's doing any financial transactions with the North Koreans. In the case of China, we have one specific manufacturing company that the U.S. Treasury Department and the Justice Department have come out and sanctioned, and that specifically the Chinese as well have come after. When we look at this issue, though, of secondary sanctions, one of the complaints has been that we haven't done enough on this side. Is this something to where we need to sort of go after and sanction a large number of banks or other institutions quickly, or is what perhaps maybe the approach demonstrated by this one case be more effective to where we build solid evidence, present it to the Chinese, and then essentially let them put it within their own system for violations within China?
Right. Again, very good questions. I think it has to do, the question is motivated in part by a confusion, which is not your confusion, but just a general confusion about what's meant by secondary sanctions. Because the secondary sanctions actually encompass two somewhat different things. First of all, after a long comment period following the legislation, which was passed earlier in the year by the U.S. Congress, the United States Treasury has now declared and issued a ruling that North Korea as a whole, the entire country, is a jurisdiction of money laundering concern. And what that is not exactly a sanction. It's requiring American banking institutions to do due diligence with respect to their clients and therefore demand that their clients do due diligence with respect to their accounts so that the United States is not indirectly providing clearing services to North Korea. That ruling has only gone into effect in the last month. So actually, we don't know yet at all what the effects of that will be. And it's very difficult to gauge them because unlike a trade transaction, which is visible in a current account balance or balance of payments accounting, we don't know what some of these financial transactions even are. So we don't know whether this is going to have large effect or small effect. It could have large effect if the correspondent banks that are dealing with their American counterparts really need access to the American market and believe that the North Korean business is not worth doing. And so we could actually see a quite dramatic effect. But it's also the case that we don't really know how North Korea banks, and it could be that they're banking in small provincial or even municipal banks in China or in Russia or in other weak jurisdictions that really think that they can take the risk of doing North Korea business. So I just don't have any clue about what the effects of that sanction would be, but they're certainly not going to become manifest immediately. They would only come in over time. The second type of secondary sanction really involves financial intelligence. And the reason why the case that you've talked about, Hongxiang, is so stunning is because it was an open source report by a research group that essentially identified a firm that had been doing $500 million of business with North Korea over a six-year period. Now, I have respect for the people who are at Treasury who are working on these issues, but why aren't we doing this is the natural question. So I think that moving forward on the secondary sanctions front, the way that the administration handled this, I think, is totally appropriate, which is they took this open source information, they presented it to the Chinese and said, look, we're willing to work with you on this, but in the meantime, we're indicting the members, the top management of this firm on sanctions violations charges, and you can do what you want, but we're imposing secondary sanctions on them. Not just secondary sanctions, they were actually indicted. And so I think that really is a model of saying these are firms which are that China, we don't believe that you're knowledgeable or know that these activities are going on. They're obviously happening beneath the radar. We're perfectly happy to work with you on identifying those kinds of those types of entities. And it was interesting that the Chinese acted with alacrity in actually arresting the CEO of one portion of the Hongxiang group that was involved in these activities. So I think that is certainly a model that we should use moving forward.
One thing I'd like to talk with you about before we close, you know, we've talked a lot about sanctions, their effectiveness, what they mean, and there are other things that people discuss sanctioning. And I mean, some of them are sort of hinted at in 2321. You know, and you've talked about them briefly, the North Korean labor exports, perhaps some other activities as well. But one of the things I'd like to sort of flip the question, if you will, and almost say, are there things that maybe we should consider not sanctioning or that would not be in our interest to sanction?
If you'd asked me that question 3 years ago, maybe even 2 years ago, I would say that we had an interest in promoting commercial engagement on the part of North Korea. And if they're doing offshore processing, if they're operating in that vein. But I, with the acceleration of the tests, it's hard to identify much that I think shouldn't be subject to sanction outside of absolute necessities. I don't think that the NGO activity or humanitarian activity should be hampered. I think that granting exemptions to sanctions to NGOs to operate there is something which should be done swiftly and clearly. I think the ability of NGOs to manage their financial transactions with North Korea, it's very important that that go forward. And not only for moral reasons, honestly, even though I think those are the most significant ones, but also because I think it's important to signal both to the people of North Korea and to China that the intention of these sanctions is not to impose any more distress than we need to impose. I think it's wrong to think that sanctions don't impose distress. They're designed to impose distress. But I think it's very important to signal that the United States continues to believe that humanitarian assistance to North Korea, if warranted, is warranted, and that we should participate in delivering it. But I think that the situation has gotten so grave with respect to the development of North Korean capabilities that I worry about reactions that will be more direct, which might have higher costs. So I think it's important to try to put in place as robust a sanctions regime as we can so that we can get back to the talks, which will inevitably be the only way that denuclearization is likely to transpire.
Well, this has been a very informative and a very interesting conversation. Thank you for joining us again on Korean Context.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks for joining us here on Korean Context. Just a friendly reminder that our podcast is available on iTunes, and it's also available for Android devices on whatever podcast app you prefer. It's also available on our website, www.keia.org, where we also have a lot of great research and other resources about Korea. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you here again next week.